For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today I'm talking to you from the broom cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and I'm once again in my bedroom. But coming up on today's show,
Hayley Doyle introduces us to her new rom-com, Never Saw You Coming.
I'll talk to Molly Flatt of The Big Book Weekend about the recording of her book, The Charmed Life of Alex Moore.
David Farrier takes us hunting for the fossils of tomorrow in his new book, Footprints.
And we'll have the books of my life from both Molly Flatt and Hayley Doyle.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Hayley Doyle is an actress and author from Liverpool whose delightful new novel, Never Saw You Coming, has just entered the RNIB library as part of our special relationship with publisher HarperCollins. And here is Hayley to tell us more about the novel and herself. Hayley Doyle, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Hello, Red. So nice for you to have me on.
Well, it's lovely to have you and a really upbeat story on the show. Can you give us a taste of the plot?
Yes, of course. So it doesn't start very uplifting, but it definitely goes on that journey and hopefully gives the readers a few laughs along the way as well, because there are a lot of comedy moments within the story. And it's kind of your typical boy meets girl with a very unconventional twist. So you've got the two protagonists, male and female. Our male is Jim. And he is a Scouse lad from Liverpool who works in a toll booth. And our female protagonist is Zara, who is an expat who's grown up all over the world, mainly in Dubai. And so you've got Jim, who's very, very rude, Scouse roots and very stuck in his ways. And Zara, who's very flighty and very rudeless for the term. And it's about how something happens where their worlds literally collide. And the journey that takes place after this meeting.
As you say, it doesn't start particularly upbeat, but it's a very hopeful novel. It's a book where anything is possible and people have to work hard to make it possible, but the rewards are there.
Absolutely. Now, a lot of people ask me, is it autobiographical? Is it based on anyone I know? It's not. It's completely fictional. There are no real Zara and Jim in real life. But the whole message of the book, that, like you said, the hopeful feeling, that idea that if a door closes on you, a window does open somewhere else, that was my idea for the book. And in that sense, what happens to them did happen to me. I don't want to say too much. I don't want to give too much away. But there was definitely a feeling I had when I was around their age. And if you take a chance on something and believe, then what you think might happen might not happen, but it opens the path for something else, which is maybe the path you were supposed to go on all along. And that's the message I wanted to get across in this book, rather than just a typical boy meets girl. There's definitely, I hope, more to it than just a guy meets a girl.
Well, it's a lovely love story, but yeah, it's very much a novel for our times, that there are always opportunities. We might not be able to go outdoors, but we can strengthen our relationships at home and over the phone and Zoom.
Well, of course. I mean, talking is everything. I'm a big talker, if you already hadn't guessed. I spent a career being an actress and on the radio. So, but being a writer as well, we have to have sort of an introverted side to us to go off and sit for weeks and months on end on our own, getting into our own little world in our heads of creating characters and narration and stories. And human connection is so important when you've got a job like that, when you do sort of sit and you have to just think in your own head so much. So yeah, connecting with people in any way we can at the moment is so, so important, because we can't just walk down to the coffee shop and meet our friends, and we can't just pop round to someone's house or go to the pub. So it's very, very important to keep those conversations going.
As a writer, are you looking at this as an opportunity to get cracking on the second novel, or are your young children seeing that mummy is always there and dragging you into the sitting room to play with Lego?
There's lots and lots of uplifting and funny things going around social media at the moment, isn't there? To just make us all laugh during these dark times. And I've seen a lot of things that say, what people do without kids during the lockdown and what people do with kids and all these wonderful things that these people are doing, all these, you know, someone can learn a language and they're going to finally learn to play the piano and write that book that they've always wanted to write. Then you've got the people with small kids who are just like, my house is a tip. I haven't done anything. I tried to do a craft and it ended in tears. And it's just, so writing my second book at the moment is definitely proving to be a challenge. However, I've got the bare bones of it done before all this chaos kicked off. So I'm currently editing my second book, which is not going as quickly as I'd like, but the edits are what I'm working on. So it's not like I need to think of an entirely new concept and new characters. It's all there. I've just got to tighten it and redraft it at the moment.
And you mentioned that people have asked whether this book is autobiographical. I was reading your background. I mean, some of it reads just like the plot of a great novel. You have had such an eventful life.
I know.
For the listeners who haven't done their background check on you, can you just tell us a little bit about what you have achieved in your short life already?
Well, as a child, I always wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be a performer. And went to the usual dance classes and things like that. And I did a lot of performing as a kid. And I eventually got into a drama school after I did my A-levels. And from drama school, I moved to London to audition as an actress and got into Mamma Mia in the West End. So that was amazing. I did that for over a year. And it was during then that I started experimenting with being a novelist as well, because I kind of had the time. I'd come home from a show quite buzzy. All my housemates were in bed and I would just write into the early hours of the morning when everything was really quiet. And I loved it. So I did a master's in novel writing and loved that so much that I didn't really want to go back to the audition circuit. I'd thrown myself into this master's degree. And it felt in my gut that it was what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be a writer. So I got a bit nervous about when the course was going to come to an end. And I thought, right, I need to just go do something different for a while. Maybe I should live abroad, but oh, I don't speak any other languages. My GCSE French isn't going to get me very far. So I got a job in Dubai, which has a huge expat community. And it was just for 6 months to teach musical theatre. And I ended up staying for nearly 7 years. Set up my own theatre school over there and became a regular voice on talk radio out there as well. And during my time out there as well, I met a man who I'm now married to and we've got two kids. And that's where we are now. Where the journey takes us next, who knows?
Wow. And during that time, I believe you also appeared on stage with somebody who's a very close friend of R&IB, Brian Blessed.
Oh, Brian, blessed. Hands down, the hardest working actor I've ever worked with, ever. He was amazing. He played Captain Hook in Peter Pan. It was my first professional job after drama school. And I was Tiger Lily and the maid at the beginning. Like, even in drama school, I always got the part of the comedy maid. The amount of times I had to don a black dress with a little white pinny. And I did in Peter Pan. And then I played Tiger Lily in the second half and Captain Hook was played by the fabulous Brian Blessed. And he would come into rehearsals and the second he walked through the door, he was in work mode. There was no kind of, oh, grab a coffee, let's have a chat. Oh, let's kind of put off rehearsing while we just mess about. No, he was in the room, bang. What are we going to do? How are we going to make this show better? You got to do this, you got to do that. And he was just on fire. And then he'd leave. And there was just this energy disappeared out of the room. He was just a force. And I'm so, so lucky to have had that experience.
Well, he is Titch the Elf every year for us at Christmas. And having been in the same studio as him, I don't think there's enough room to hold the energy sometimes. He's an amazing, amazing character.
Oh, wonderful. And the things he's done with his life is just mind-blowing. Like, he's climbed Everest.
I know, it's phenomenal. Well, there's a challenge ahead of you, Hayley. You know, when you finish the second novel, maybe a mountain lies ahead of you.
Well, I'd like to ski down a mountain. I'm not sure about climbing up one. But yeah, give me a pair of skis and I'll somehow make my way down it.
Now, there's a terrific audiobook version of Never Saw You Coming, which has just entered the RNIB library so that book lovers with sight loss can enjoy the story as well. Presumably, it was very important for you to make the book as accessible to as many people as possible.
Oh, yes, of course. And what was very important to me with this book was getting the right guy to play Jim because of the accent. Jim being a Scouser, there's all different variations of Scouse accents. And also there's lots of talented actors out there who can do a Scouse accent. Like, you know, I went to drama school and I can do other accents as well, but I really wanted it to be authentic. I really pushed for it to be an authentic Scouser who can do a variation of different Scouse accents, because although the narrator, Jim, is from Liverpool, all his mates as well, you've got his mum, his ma, you've got hair friends, you've got the sisters who've moved away, so their accent will have changed. And you've got just general people working in a shop, you've got the people working in the toll booth. And there's just so much melody in regional accents. And it was very important to me to get the right actor, and we got him. And I'm so pleased because he's absolutely brilliant. And the same with Zara, the girl who plays Zara. She can do so many brilliant accents, and she just sounds so sweet and vulnerable, but at the same time, she's so feisty. And I couldn't be happier with the actors, Stephen Fletcher and Georgia Maguire. They're just amazing. And I really hope the listeners warm to them.
It was like having an entire theatre full of actors narrating the book. It was a joy to listen to, and I think listeners are in for a treat.
You're live on air, Merseywave 103.4.
You are. Connie's husky laugh takes over. You're live on The Breakfast Show with Connie and Carl, Jim. Now's your chance to become a winner.
A winner?
Stretching ahead of me and behind me is grey tarmac. That single word, winner, is not part of my daily vocabulary. The two simple syllables sounding full and foreign in my mouth, my breath still fresh from instant coffee.
You're head to head with Sophie, Carl says. Say hi to Jim, Sophie.
Hiya, Jim,
a crackled voice says, the slight echo confirming that Sophie's using a hands-free kit from her car. And yet, who is this Sophie? And why is she with me live on the radio?
Never Saw You Coming by my guest, Hayley Doyle, is narrated by Stephen Fletcher and Georgia Maguire. And I believe there's a link to sight loss within your own family.
Yes, unfortunately, my nan, she has been suffering with sight problems for a few years now. She just turned 90 the other day. Isn't that fabulous? And it's really sad we couldn't celebrate with her, but we're so looking forward to celebrating with her when all this craziness is over. But she's started losing like the middle of her sight, so she can sort of see around the edges, but not in the middle. And it's going to be amazing for her to listen to this book, because she has been my number one fan since the day I was born. I was her first grandchild, and it was my nan that got me into singing and dancing. And I would sit at her table and write stories, wanting to be a novelist. I used to design the front covers for my future novels, all in her house. Her energy just sparked such a creativity within me, and writing, telling stories. She was always telling a story. So now that I've got a published book that she can listen to, read by two amazing actors, I couldn't ask for more right now, because otherwise she wouldn't be able to read it, or we'd have to go round to her flat and read it to her. So it's going to be such a treat for her when she gets it.
Well, what a terrific birthday present for her. And what a wonderful distraction from the COVID virus lockdown for the rest of us. Hayley Doyle, it has been an absolute delight talking to you. I will let you get back to your nine-month-old who I think has been very good in the background, and hope that you come back onto the show when the next novel is published.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me, Red.
Never Saw You Coming by Hayley Doyle is TB705367. And Hayley will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
And that won't be the only books of your life on today's show. Last week, I spoke to Molly Flatt, one of the co-founders, along with Kit Deval, of the Big Book Weekend. And if you search for Big Book Weekend or go to bigbookweekend.com, you can still see all of last weekend's events. While Molly was on the line, I asked her about her book, The Charmed Life of Alex Moore. Before we hear that chat, let's hear a clip.
Alex took a breath, then froze. For the briefest moment, she had no idea how she had come to be standing on this upturned beer crate in this vast and ugly room, staring back at the faces of 100 hungry strangers. "Tell us," they pleaded with bleary eyes and wetly gaping mouths. "Tell us your secret." Before she could stop it, a memory surfaced of her 13-year-old self, paralysed centre stage and stammering like an idiot, in her first and last school play. Seconds later, "Oh God, not now, not again." The memory blurred and shivered. The vertigo drop-kicked her belly. The emptiness opened up inside. Who the hell was she? Why the hell was she here?
The Charmed Life of Alex Moore is my own book, and you can indeed get an audio version. And I'm very glad that I didn't have to narrate the audio book, because it's set in between Orkney and London and features many, many accents which I wouldn't have a hope in heaven of replicating. So yes, it's a kind of thrilling modern adventure about a woman who works in the tech industry in London but stumbles across a kind of strange, sinister secret that takes her very much out of her comfort zone to the Orkney Islands to discover why she's suddenly been rocketed to stratospheric success. So my agent described this book as Bridget Jones meets The Matrix, which is still the way I try and pitch it, because I haven't found anything better.
And it's wonderfully narrated by Sophie Bleasdale. Have you had a chance to listen to it?
Well, I was lucky enough to actually be there when Sophie started recording. So I met her in the recording studio and we had a chat about the book, which was really incredible because at that point, hardly anyone had read the book other than my editor. And in fact, even my mum hadn't read the book. She certainly wasn't allowed to read it until it was published. So it was wonderful talking to her about my characters as if they were real. You know, she was one of those first readers. And she had loads of questions to ask. So I sat and listened to her read the prologue and the first chapter. And she asked me a few questions. And that was absolutely fascinating, seeing how the process of the audiobook came together and seeing how she worked through the text of the book and how she was thinking through how to present the characters and things. I must admit, Robert, since then, I just can't bear to bring myself to listen to it. You know, I've written so many drafts of this book, I just think it would be utterly cringy listening to my own words, you know, again, kind of coming from someone else's mouth. So maybe in 10 years when I've got a bit more distance on it, but I'm assured that it is a fantastic production, which I have no doubt, because Sophie was a really wonderful and talented woman.
I've heard that it's quite a strange feeling watching someone read your book.
Really, really, really strange. I think especially if you're just a lifelong reader, a lifelong fan. I'm such a fan and have loved audiobooks and, you know, used to listen to them when I was kind of pulling weeds for my mum in the garden. She used to give me like a few pence per bucket and I used to have on my, you know, it would have been not even a CD man back then. It would have been a proper old Walkman. And I had a series of kind of BBC classics tapes I used to read while picking weeds out of the garden. And, you know, to be sitting there and listening to my words as if they were a proper book, really, which of course, you know, they have quite unbelievably became, was utterly surreal. And I must say, of all the moments in the publication process, sitting in that audio booth was probably the most extraordinary, actually. You know, forget the launch party and, you know, we went on tour with the paperback and things like that. That was great. But I really think that was the moment where it really sunk in, because seeing the care that the producer, who was also incredible, and Sophie, the narrator, went to bring this book to life as if it was their own, it really was like watching someone kind of take your baby and look after it perhaps better than even than yourself. So that will forever be embedded in my muscle memory, I think, as a moment when I really shivered, realised it was happening.
And of course, the very fact that it's available in audio opens it up to a whole new audience for whatever reason can't access print.
Absolutely, and that's hugely important to me. You know, I think I was very privileged to be brought up with easy access to books, with parents who loved books, and with kind of no barriers to me reading and becoming a bookworm. And it's been such an endless delight and inspiration in my life. And, you know, especially at times like these during lockdown, when I think voices that can summon you away to other worlds, that can either help you make sense of the situation right now, provide pure escapism, or just kind of make you feel less alone, which I think books are absolutely brilliant in doing, and audiobooks in particular. I think it's so important that everyone has the chance for that, whatever their, you know, physical abilities, their background, their location, their education, their upbringing. I'm so feeling that, yeah, my book was made into an audiobook, which just increased its reach, was really, really important to me.
And as Molly's such a fan of books, I had to ask her for the books of her life. So Molly, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, wow. Absolutely. I mean, so many. And sometimes I find it almost hard to remember what I read in childhood because I was such an addicted, voracious reader. I gobbled them down so quickly that I think sometimes they didn't really touch the sides. But one that stands out is absolutely The Owl Service by Alan Garner. And in fact, that whole series of books Garner wrote, I think the sheer weirdness of that book and his writing in general really appealed to me. It had a dank, strange fantasy element. It's about these children who discover a place, essentially, you know, the Owl Service, some crockery with a mysterious pattern on it. And it takes them into a whole realm of myth and adventure and danger and excitement. And that always stayed with me. I think the link between literature and the land, if that doesn't sound too grand, was very powerful for me. I grew up in the countryside. I spent most of my time running around in fields by myself. And the fact that I loved books too, it kind of really brought those two things together. It's an incredibly powerful book. And I just love how weird it is. I love how weird so many children's books are. And it's just a reflection, you know, now I'm a mum myself, of really how bizarre kids' minds are in the best possible way. I think it really fueled that strange nascent imagination I had.
How's the bellyache then? Gwyn stuck his head round the door. Alison sat in the iron bed with brass knobs. Porcelain columns showed the infant Bacchus, and there was a lump of slate under one leg because the floor dipped. "A bore," said Alison, "and I'm too hot."
"Tough," said Gwyn.
"Couldn't find any books, or I brought one I had from school. I'm supposed to be reading it for literature, but you're welcome. It looks deadly."
"Thanks anyway," said Alison.
"Roger's gone for a swim. You wanted company, are you?"
"Don't put yourself out for me," said Alison.
"Right," said Gwyn. "Cheerio."
He rode sideways down the banisters on his arms to the first floor landing.
"Gwyn?" "Yeah? What's the matter? You okay?"
"Quick.
You want a basin? You're going to throw up, are you?"
"Gwyn." He ran back. Alison was kneeling on the bed.
"Listen," she said. "Can you hear that?"
The Owl Service by Alan Garner is available in giant print and as Talking Book number 5881, narrated by Gabriel Wolfe. Is there a book on a rainy day that you return to again and again?
There is, not just a book, Robert, but a whole series. In fact, two series. A series of books by an author called Dorothy Dunnett, who was a Scottish civil servant, actually. And she's not that well known. It's one of those examples. I don't know if other people get these with other favourite authors of theirs. If they're not very well known, but then if you find someone else who knows that author, it's often one of their favourite authors. And you feel like you've kind of met a soulmate in a second when they know who you're talking about. So Dorothy Dunnett wrote a few standalones as well, but also a couple of quite iconic series of historical adventures, really. One is set in the, I think it's the 14th century, the Niccolo series. And then Francis Crawford of Limmond is the anti-hero of the second series, which is set in the 16th century. And these are incredible kind of 8-book epic that take you all across the medieval world. So, you know, a book tends to focus on a particular trade or a particular area of the world where our anti-hero Romes. And when you talk about them, they can sound incredibly kind of cliched, bodice ripper, OTT historical dramas. When you read them, the clarity and breadth of Dorothy Dunnett's mind, she writes bits in Latin and in French. She has this encyclopedic knowledge of everything from Venetian glass blowing through to, French warfare. She wears her research very lightly. You really care about the characters. They feel like real people. They are incredibly ambiguous, at once totally knowable, but also incredibly ambiguous, and they're always surprising you. Their dialogue is so real. It's full of absences and assumptions and ellipses and misunderstandings. And I just find they have everything you could really want from a novel, or certainly everything I could want for a novel, which is a combination of deep reality and insight, learning. I've learned so much from them. I still understand probably about 40% of them, having read them several times through my life, but also sheer enjoyment.
Just wait!
McCulloch was roaring.
Just wait, man! Protector Somerset will get his damned English rabble together and march into Scotland up the east coast, and he'll tell off his commander, Lord Wharton, to get his Cumberland English together and invade us at the same time up the west coast. And half the west coast landowners are pensioners of the English already and won't resist him. And all the rest of us will be over here at Edinburgh fighting Ned Somerset.
Not all of us, said Erskine neatly. McCulloch's whiskers promenaded.
All stay in the west, that's worth a docking.
All of the Francis Crawford of Lemon sagas and the House of Niccolo books by Dorothy Dunnett are available in the RNIB library, including this one, the Francis Crawford of Lemon saga book 1, The Game of Kings, narrated by David Thorpe. It's talking book number 15560. And is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
Well, this is actually brand new. It only came out in April 2020, and it's by, full disclosure, a friend of mine, a fantastic science writer called Gemma Milne, who I came to know through her writing, and she does a brilliant newsletter, email newsletter called Brain Reel as well. Her book is called Smoke and Mirrors, How Hype Obscures the Future and How to See Past It. It's a really great book that kind of challenges all these bombastic headlines we have about science and technology. Everything from AI, quantum computing, to cancer drugs, future foods, all things that can sound really exciting. And I come from a background in kind of tech consultancy and tech journalism, so I'm really interested in this kind of stuff. But it can be really hard to feel like you're getting the truth, the scientific truth, the realistic picture, the up-to-date details on this beyond all the hype. And Gemma's book is brilliant for that. It's written so that it's so accessible. It's a really great, compelling read. But I think it's a really important book, actually, nowadays, to kind of see past all the hype that we get, especially around the areas of science and technology, where I think many people feel like they are incapable of really using their own judgment to know what's true and what's not. Of course, I'm doing that thing now where you speak for yourself and project onto other people. That's how I feel. So yeah, I just recommend it. It's a great fresh book. It's a book very much for now. It's well written, it's accessible, and it's something really different.
What does it mean to be accidentally filled, to be swept up in tantalising ideas or trusted opinions or simple hope that something false is true? To be tricked somewhat, not out of malice from a magician of sorts behind the scenes, but by simplified narrative, distracted focus, or an unchecked desire for something to be true cloaking rational thought. This powerful tool, capable of misleading, is hype. And it's powerful because it's not always a tool that someone somewhere has chosen to wield, but because it can so easily be misconstrued, carelessly used, and spread like wildfire. There are many stories of lying, deception, and misuse of power, but I'd argue that hype can be even more damaging than deliberate, sometimes criminal, actions. Conspiracies, too, make for intriguing reading, but the curious power of hype is one that, in my mind, makes for an under-discussed truth much stranger and more compelling than speculation. Before we go on, we should probably define hype. Some describe it as extravagant or intensive promotion. Others define it as the use of a lot of advertising to make people interested in something. Others go for, simply, exaggerated publicity. Whatever specific word you go for, it's clear that when we use hype to describe sentiment, it is somewhat biased towards a particular perception, not because of the facts about its merit, but because of the particular words and narratives surrounding it. Sometimes those words and narratives are warranted, sometimes they are not. Sometimes hype perfectly encapsulates the future being built, sometimes it obscures it. Sometimes it results in socially beneficial over-embellishment, sometimes it changes the course of progress for the worse. The crucial thing then is not to halt all hype or banish its use across the board, but instead to understand when we are presented with hype and how to sort the fair from the problematic. Hype, like any tool, isn't inherently good or bad. It can be the tool with which we gather communities around positive societal change, and it can be the tool that misleads to satisfy the ill-conceived wants of a few immoral actors.
Smoke and Mirrors, How Hype Obscures the Future and How to See Past It is written and read by Gemma Milne and is available commercially. Molly Flatt, thanks so much for sharing your love of books and reading with the Read On listeners.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. And talking of non-fiction, what fossils will mankind leave behind for future generations? And what will those generations make of the lives that we led? These are the questions at the heart of Footprints in Search of Future Fossils, a new book by David Farrier, who joined me over Zoom to tell me more.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You take as your starting point for the book some ancient footprints that were found by a river in Norfolk, things that should never have survived but did survive for millennia. From there, you look at the throwaway things mankind has produced and how they are likely to outsurvive us.
Yeah, Footprints is really a story about how do we want to be remembered ourselves, remembered to the deep future? As you say, the book opens with an account of the discovery of a series of fossilised footprints outside Haysborough in East Anglia. They were uncovered by a seasonal storm and they're 850,000 years old, or they were. They only lasted, I think, a couple of weeks before being exposed, let alone being eroded away. But of course, they're an accidental trace of our very distant ancestors that just seem to sort of suddenly erupt in our present. What really struck me about those footprints was that their discovery was pretty much coincident with the announcement at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii that for the first time in recorded history, we had passed the threshold of 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. It was seen as a kind of boundary. And it was this coincidence of footprints arising out of the past and then this announcement of passing a boundary ourselves that will carry us into the deep future really struck me as asking this question, how do we want to be remembered? It's been projected that the carbon we've put into the atmosphere already will take around 100,000 years to be fully weathered away, until all of it's been moved on by the carbon cycle and locked up in rocks and so on. That is a long legacy, and it's going to be playing a role in shaping the world that our descendants will live in. And it really provoked me to think, well, how do we want to be remembered? What is our impact on the deep future going to be? And what kind of story will that tell about us?
The deep future is many millions of years in the future. And you look into the deep past for information on how the fossils that we leave behind are going to appear. Our great cities in time will just be crushed to a meter thick layer of sediment.
Yeah, absolutely. The mega cities of the world are prime candidates to become future fossils. I visited Shanghai to try to get some greater purchase on this idea. How does a mega city like Shanghai that has something like 24 million people living in it, how does that become a fossil? What kind of impression does that leave on the deep future? Shanghai is a coastal city, and so sea level rise is an issue. It's also sinking. It's sunk by over 2 metres, possibly 2.5 metres in the past 100 years, largely because of the extraction of groundwater, but also because of the immense weight of the city pressing down on what is actually really rather soft, boggy ground. And really, the story of a city like that becoming a fossil is one of inundation by the sea and then pressure and time. These cities are unlikely to leave a trace on the surface, but the subterranean level, particularly if the surface is inundated, covered by sediment and seawater and so on, are very, very likely over time to form these kind of fossilized layers. And as you say, eventually leaving this kind of comparatively thin stripe in the strata, maybe 100 million years from now, that is nonetheless distinct and legible as something that was once made not by the action of geological processes and planetary cycles, but by the intervention of some living thing. There'll be the presence of artificial materials that don't exist naturally. There will be the outline, perhaps even, of everyday objects, things that we see around us all the time will punctuate this thin layer in the rock record. And it's a startling thing to imagine that the world we've made might leave a legible trace, a legacy that persists over that timescale. Really, for me, and this is perhaps where my kind of background in teaching English literature and so on comes in, but future fossils are stories. They're stories in the making, stories that we're already, in a sense, telling to the deep future about ourselves and how we live. And what I hope is that thinking about future fossils are stories that we're telling to the deep future, to the people who will follow us, might help us to think more carefully about what we want that story to be.
You mentioned that you teach English at Edinburgh University, and one of your inspirations for the approach that you've taken with footprints are the Stirling Hills that loom over the city, and the fact that you can see the geology, you can see the strata of rock that started off at the South Pole that has now been pushed all the way up to the Northern Hemisphere, and it's buckled up. And that's a very powerful image, showing that even though a 1 metre layer of our mega cities might be buried underground, it could always be pushed up to the surface.
Yeah, there is the potential for, in the very deep future, for some of these subterranean legacies to be revealed again. Absolutely. It's quite striking to think about that in the context of roads, which might also leave some kind of fossil trace. We've wrapped the planet in something like 50 million kilometres of roads, and maybe even only 1% of that vast network might leave a trace. Most of it perhaps derived from subterranean roads, tunnels and so on. But it is a startling idea that perhaps that, you know, a short section of the roads that we travel down now might be preserved in a tunnel somewhere, and then gradually over many, many millions of years be raised up to the surface, almost like raising a bridge up into the sky.
One image that really struck me was the underwater clinker roads that have been created by trade over the last 200 years.
Yeah, so perhaps not quite so much of the terrestrial road network will linger, but absolutely right. There is already a kind of clinker pavement in many parts of the world that has been laid down by global shipping, by the dumping over the side of clinker and other kinds of waste material that has settled and formed this kind of very durable layer in parts of the ocean floor. And again, some of this will be lost to subduction as the ocean floor remolds itself, but some of it will linger, and particularly it's concentrated around ports, because, you know, ships would often in the 19th century and so on dispose of out of this material when in port. And so it's conceivable that even if it's only a fragmentary trace, it would be possible to reconstruct a sense of just how densely plotted this global network was, thinking about how these concentrations in ports, or what were once port areas around the world, might be connected by these fragments of clinker road that are dotted around the ocean floor.
And of course, the plastics that clog the oceans.
Durability of plastic in and of itself is not so great that a single piece of plastic might outlast the human race, but it's about the kind of cycles that we've introduced plastic into. So a piece of plastic, a bottle, whatever it might be, might endure for between, say, 300 or 400 years and 1,000 years. But having introduced so much of this material to the oceans, it's now circulating and gradually settling to the ocean floor, where much of it will be covered by sediment, and a good proportion of it, particularly if it forms in concentrations that are large enough, might, again, over very, very deep time, is submit to this same story of time and pressure and heat, and effectively revert back to the material from which it's made, as in form new deposits of oil, in which case we can absolutely say that this material has a kind of reach into the deep future that could well extend beyond anything that we can imagine for ourselves.
I found the cyclical nature of plastic that had been made from oil returning to oil quite comforting until I read just how much damage it does to the organisms in the sea during the time that it's degrading.
Plastic is a material that we might think of as inert, partly because of its durability, partly because of the way we use it. Plastic surrounds us, but we tend not to see it. It's something that we have learned to call upon in moments when we need it, and really to discard or at least put it out of our minds when we're not using it. But plastic is a deeply and richly storied material, and that, you can imagine, is a story that reaches back into the deep past through its origins in fossil fuels, but also reaches into the deep future. And in the course of that long arc is interacting in all kinds of often very damaging ways with particularly marine life. It's one of the most alarming aspects of the plastic pollution that we fill the oceans with is just how much it mimics life for a lot of marine creatures. I mean, plastic bags look a lot like jellyfish, for example, which turtles are very keen on eating. And so plastic in the oceans is not just kind of running through its own very deep time circuit or transit, but it's moving through many more short-term cycles where it enters the digestive system of seabirds and other marine creatures, gradually clogs those creatures' gullets so that they can't take on nutrients. And then once the animal has died and its body has rotted away, the plastic is released again into the cycle and moves through this again and again and again. So the liveliness of plastic is something I think we would do well to take hold of and appreciate much more carefully. It's a challenge to perceive the deep future and to think about deep time as something that is not just distant and remote, but very intimate and present for us. But I do think that with some patience and perhaps with just a minimum of attention to the world we live in, we can begin to see it as a world that is very much one that is leaving a deep impression on the planet and on the planet's future.
You use archaeology, geology, literature, philosophy to look at the materials that are going to be our future fossils from every side to recognise that they are both useful but have a very long legacy, maybe none longer than nuclear waste.
Quite, yes. And that is really a story of how do we care for the deep future. Spent nuclear fuel has an astonishing half-life. We're talking about spent plutonium. It's over 24,000 years. And of course, it's material that will remain lethal for generations that very much disappear over our temporal horizon. And many scientists, engineers, politicians have been preoccupied with how do we make this material safe so that it remains safe for people who may not be born for 10,000 years. And in Footprints, I look at various different schemes to make this material safe against intrusion, against the curiosity of people who will follow us. And we know ourselves to be a very curious species. And there's some remarkable stories that emerge out of this. In New Mexico, there is a facility called the Waste Isolation Processing Plant, where the plan is to build a whole series of monuments and markers in the landscape that will communicate the danger of entering that site. But the problem, of course, they have is that there is no iconography, no language that has remained current and in use for 10,000 years. There's almost no precedent for this kind of deep future communication. So one of the solutions that they came up with was to build this very monumental landscape, but to punctuate it with lots of images of a human face displaying disgust that's modelled on Edvard Munch's painting The Scream. The thinking being that this is such a visceral image, so essential, its meaning far outstrips the need for any kind of explanation, that this will have the potency and the potential to carry its message that deeply into the future. But I also went to visit a project in Finland that takes a diametrically opposed approach to this problem of how to communicate the danger of nuclear waste for 10,000 years. So at a site called Onkalo on the coast of the Bothnian Sea, They are building a repository for this material deep in the earth and nearly 500 meters deep in the bedrock. But the plan is not to mark it at all. They're simply going, when it's finished and then full, which might take about 130 years, they will simply backfill all of the tunnels and then let nature grow over the site and allow it to be forgotten, which again is a remarkable thought if you consider what might go through the mind of someone who happens to come across this site, who has no context for thinking about what's down there and finds the remains of this great engineering project buried deep in the earth. Either way, I think it's a story of care, but quite which one will be the one that is successfully told to the future, the one that successfully guards against intrusion, of course, we won't know, any of us.
Now, as I say, you use various disciplines to examine the question of what fossils will leave behind us. You go back through literature to the Romantic poets, Wordsworth, Coleridge and Shelley, to see how they viewed the confluence of nature and science around them. Those disciplines for the last 150 years have diverged, but do you think now mankind is looking at things as a whole rather than trying to separate them into literature and science?
I think there has been definitely a greater convergence of the sciences and the humanities, or perhaps rather the ways of looking at things that we might associate with these disciplines have converged, and perhaps a bit more. I'm thinking perhaps about the frequency now with which we hear from climate scientists who talk about the grief that they're feeling. For a long time, climate scientists felt that their obligation, even in the face of the information that they were gathering and the picture that was building, that they must remain objective. And it's striking to me that many scientists in those fields now are very readily talking about the emotional cost, about how it makes them feel, and that isn't seen as in any way in opposition to or contradictory of their objectivity.
Are you hopeful that the current lockdown is giving people pause for thought?
Yes, I guess in a cautious sense. We have, of course, been not quite in this situation before, but have seen similar moments in the recent history when it seemed as if the whole global system was shaken to its foundations and it very readily reasserted itself. I'm thinking about 2008 and afterwards. I think what's different now with the lockdown is that we've been given very ready images in some respects of what a new world could look like, with far less traffic on the roads, with far fewer planes in the air, with heavy industry silenced, and with government stepping in and showing a great deal more willingness to support businesses, to support societies, being much more hands-on in that respect. And all of this does give some hope, but what we have to hold on to is the thought that it's down to us to make this happen. If we simply allow things to unfold, then I can very readily imagine that when the lockdown comes to an end, there will be a great drive to return to business as usual, to recoup ground that has been lost, to make up growth that was lost. And we can't afford that. We've been given an opportunity to see how things could be different. And of course, it's not an opportunity anyone would have chosen. I have absolutely no time for the arguments that suggest that this is a good thing for the planet, and that it's somehow worth the cost in lives. Absolutely not. Nonetheless, I do think we have been given a glimpse of something, but it is down to us to make it a reality, to make it permanent, to bring perhaps the slightly slower, quieter, more attentive, more caring world that we've got a glimpse of in these past few weeks into fullness.
Now, RNIB library users can enjoy the audiobook version of Footprints, which is rather brilliantly read by Mike Grady.
I was approached by the publisher who suggested Mike as someone who was known to do an excellent job and was very highly regarded for work he'd done before. And I was absolutely thrilled that they'd chosen to approach him, and absolutely delighted with the job that he's done.
Well, David Farrier, thank you so much for coming onto the show and introducing us to Footprints and some of the very thought-provoking arguments that you put in it. Footprints, In Search of Future Fossils by David Farrier, is available from the RNIB Library as TB705175. Now it's back to Hayley Doyle for the books of her life. So, Hayley, was there a book that you read as a child or a very young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, I mean, I was always reading. I was one of those kids who was a total bookworm. And the book that completely made me want to be a writer was Little Women, Louisa May Alcott. It was the first book I ever read that didn't have pictures in it. And I think I was quite young as well. I can't remember exactly how old I was when I read the whole thing, because there were lots of film versions I could watch as well. Like, I used to watch an old black and white version, and there was a cartoon version. But when I got the book, I remember it was also the book on my shelf that the spine fell apart on, because I'd read it so many times. And I can remember the first line, you know, "Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents," grumbled Joe. And Josephine March is just my heroine in a time like that. And she just came out on top as a female writer, writing from the heart. It just gives me all the right tingles. And it's my absolute ultimate favourite story. It's a story, even though it's set almost 200 years ago, it just resonates now for women and how women are treated and what's expected of them. And it's a genius book in so many ways, but it definitely got me into, like, properly reading books as a child. It went from, you know, picture books and that to, okay, this is a book with chapters and a story and where you use your imagination. And it was that book that did it for me.
"Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents," grumbled Joe, lying on the rug. "It's so dreadful to be poor," sighed Meg, looking down at her old dress. "I don't think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of pretty things and other girls nothing at all," added little Amy with an injured sniff. "We've got father and mother and each other," said Beth contentedly from her corner. The four young faces on which the firelight shone brightened at the cheerful words, but darkened again as Joe said sadly, "We haven't got father, and shall not have him for a long time."
Little Women by Louisa May Alcott is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB21665, which is narrated by Liza Ross. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread as comfort food?
Well, it's actually a book I read quite recently because it was released last year, and it's Sweet Sorrow by David Nicholls. Now, I love David Nicholls. Like, he's my favourite contemporary writer, and a lot of what he writes just absolutely sings to me, because I think he used to be an actor, and so he's probably had similar experiences and similar extroverts and introverts that he's met along the way to base his characters on. So when he wrote Sweet Sorrow, which came out last year, it's set in 1997 during the summer of where the main character gets his GCSE results and has a youth theatre experience. And that's what I did in 1997. Awaiting my GCSE results, I went and did youth theatre. And it was the summer, you know, Princess Diana passed away. And there's so much of the nostalgia of that summer that when I read this book, it brought so many memories back to me. But it was also a really beautiful story with fabulously full-bodied characters that David Nicholls is so, so good at. And it's definitely a book I'd reread again.
The world would end on Thursday at 3:55, immediately after the disco. Until then, the nearest we'd come to such a cataclysm at Merton Grange were the rumours of apocalypse that took hold once or twice a term, the circumstances broadly the same each time. Nothing as banal as a solar flare or asteroid. Instead, a tabloid would report a Mayan prophecy, some throwaway remark from Nostradamus or freak symmetry of the calendar, and word would spread that our faces were due to melt off halfway through double physics. Resigned to the hysteria, the teacher would sigh and pause the lesson while we squabbled over who had the most accurate watch, and the countdown would begin. The girls clinging to each other, eyes closed and shoulders hunched, as if about to be doused with icy water, the boys brazening it out, all of us secretly contemplating the missed kiss, the unsettled score, our virginity, our friends, our parents' faces. 4, 3, 2... We'd hold our breath. Then someone would shout, "Bang," and we'd laugh, relieved and just a little disappointed to find ourselves alive, but alive in double physics. "Happy now? Let's get back to work, shall we?" and we'd return to what happens when a force of 1 newton causes a body to move through a distance of 1 meter.
Sweet Sorrow by David Nichols is narrated by Rory Kinnear and available commercially wherever you download your audiobooks. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, so recently I read, it's what I would call a super smart rom-com, and it's called If I Never Met You by Barry McFarlane. And it kind of puts the chick lit into a bit of a different category. It just rolls off the page, but it's so smart. I loved the whole idea. It's such a simple idea about how, I don't really want to say too much. I wouldn't want to give the little twist away. But it really is a lovely take on Boy Meets Girl. But the writing, I just think, is so smart. And she's so funny and she gets characters so well. And it was a very quick read. It's perfect for now, where you put my slippers on, put my feet up and read something that's just really fresh and modern, and that's just going to have you gunning for both characters all along. And it's that one, If I Never Met You.
Where are you from, Laurie? Said Carly, in the animal print top, sitting on the other side of Suzanne, and a familiar heavy lead settled in Laurie's gut. Yorkshire, she said, with the bright, oh, hell, please, can we not smile, which she knew would be lost on the recipient. You can probably tell from the accent. No, I meant, where are you from? She said, vaguely gesturing at her own face. Of course you did. The usual fork in the road opened up. Answer the question she knew they were asking, or pretend not to understand and prolong the agony. If you didn't pander to it, you were being ungracious, chippy, making a thing of it. You were the problem. Yorkshire, seriously, I was born at Huddersfield Royal. A moment ticked past and Suzanne, to no surprise whatsoever, pitched in. She means, where are your mum and dad from?
If I Never Met You by Murray McFarlane is TB705326. It's narrated by Sara Novak. Well, Hayley Doyle, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. I could talk books all day.
Me too. If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is REDSZELL.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well, and don't forget to read on.